Hello, Sandy Derby here. Welcome to Reflections of the Father's Heart podcast. You know, sometimes deconstructing what we've wrongly learned about the Father's heart is just as important as learning who He is. Join me as I sit with inspiring people who have journeyed through healing to truly understand the Father's heart. Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to our podcast, and I'm very excited about today's guest. This is a very dear friend of mine, Curtis Reed. So, Curtis, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
Sandy, thank you so much for having me. It's definitely an honor to be here.
Awesome. Well, just so all of you know, Curtis is an advanced grief recovery method specialist. He's also a transition coach, which I love, because I feel like so many of us need support and help in continuing to move forward in our lives. So I love that you have both of those things together, Curtis. And so for starters, Curtis, can you just share a little bit about yourself, what you do now, and then we'll get into some of your story and, you know, how you journeyed along the way.
So I, as you mentioned, I am an advanced grief recovery specialist, but also a transition coach. And really what that means, or how those things work together, is I try to help people to adopt grieving as a lifestyle. I'm a huge fan of grief work, of the grief recovery method. But, you know, as you know, sometimes people can find it a little bit more difficult to be consistent in dealing with some of their wounds, some of the hurts from various relationships. So what I try to do is I try to help people to really see grieving as a beneficial part of just their lives. Like I said, making it a lifestyle and helping them to ultimately grieve whatever they need to in order to experience freedom.
Which is so helpful. It's so, like you said, it's really helpful for people, because that is something that I think a lot of people struggle with, is then what to do when life continues to happen. Mm-hmm. And doing that really helps them to move forward. Now, you are now in Florida. So Curtis left me out here in California.
So sorry. Yeah. From sunshine to more sunshine, right?
You really did. Yeah. You really did. And you have children, you have a house, you're married, you have a lot going on in your life, and you also do these things. So you bring a lot of wisdom to the table. So tell us a little bit more, Curtis, about your upbringing. What was your upbringing like? What was your home like?
So I grew up in a broken home, or, you know, I come from a broken home. My parents were divorced by the time I was 5 years old. I'm biracial. So there was a lot of, for me, a lot of questions and different things about identity and who I was. My parents were both, for the most part, addicts, drug and alcohol addicts. So later in life, you know, in my teenage years, I became pretty hooked on drugs and alcohol myself. My home life was pretty, you know, it's funny, because when you're in the middle of it, you don't really see how dysfunctional things are. But looking back, I mean, there was just a lot of shame and criticizing and yelling and fighting and, really, really toxic step parents that had been brought into the picture by both of my parents, a stepfather that was a drug dealer, a stepmom who was, schizophrenic and, you know, extremely toxic and, probably even a little psychotic, but just violent. And so I think, you know, in my younger years, I think there was just, a sense of being alone, highly criticized and unprotected. And that was kind of a theme that kind of followed me throughout my childhood and young adulthood. And unfortunately, kind of followed me into even my church experience.
It makes so much sense when you say that you realize in hindsight how toxic, how dysfunctional your childhood was, because a lot of times when we're in an environment and we're being raised in it there is a level of indoctrination of things that are normalized that aren't normal.
That's right.
And then we realize later on, oh my goodness, that really wasn't normal. So then when, now did you grow up in a home that was faith-based at all? Was there any view of God?
My grandmother was, you know, she talked about God. By the time I was around and alive, she kind of stopped going to church or anything like that. Mm-hmm. My dad was pretty, you know, agnostic at the time. And as well as my mom grew up, you know, kind of in a Episcopal background, but didn't really acknowledge that later in life. So yeah, a lot of my, strange enough, my sister went to a Christian, elementary school, and she would come home. We lived in different places, but when we would meet up on the weekends, she would come home and she would talk about God, you know? So I'm like, you know, 8 years old, listening to my 6-year-old sister talk about Jesus. And I went to a community center, an after school program. It was called the Westside Jewish Community Center. And so I learned a lot about, you know, kind of the Old Testament narrative, you know, Moses and Noah. And so it was weird because even though God wasn't in my home, there was some exposure to the Bible. And you know, I felt like on some level, God was trying to still get through, you know.
And then you went on and you found a church community fairly mm-hmm. young, right?
Yeah, about 22 years old.
And yeah, how
still
did
in college.
Happen?
I was actually a junior in college.
Yeah. And how did that happen? How did you find a faith community?
I was kind of at the end of my rope. I think I was at a really young age, probably about 15 on up until about 22. Heavy drugs and alcohol, partying, the whole deal, you know. And I was just feeling desperate, like just empty. And I remember I was watching like a preacher on television late one night after I came home. I was kind of hungover. And he was saying some things that were kind of just hitting it, like, wow, I need God, you know. And I remember that night I just started praying and asking God to just show me, like, please bring me someone that can show me who you are, you know. And I had done a few churches and things, but there was just something missing, and it wasn't, you know, from my perspective, wasn't God's time or God's plan. So I ended up, I was working at this cafe on Melrose Avenue, and these kids walk in, they're about my age, and they walk up to me and they're just talking to me about this church they go to. And, you know, it was weird because even though I prayed that, it was still like a turnoff, like hearing them say this and that about church. But for whatever reason, I gave the guy my number and he followed up with me and I ended up going to church, and it was just a great group of people. I mean, there were a lot of young people, a lot of artists and musicians and different things. And, you know, because I was kind of heavily, I was in the world, I was, you know, into music and into things and all that. So, you know, it was kind of like I was seeing people that I related to, you know, cause I think from where I was standing, people at church kind of, they look like senators, or they look just like, you know, what is this? Like, I don't want to look like that. And so, you know, you're seeing these guys with dreadlocks and, you know, guys that are, you know, I was really into hip hop at that time. And, you know, so guys that really, I felt like related to me, and it was a great experience as a young convert, as a young Christian. I felt like I really had a lot, there was a lot of nurturing, a lot of things that really were put in. I feel like I was taught the Bible well and learned just some of the fundamentals of just who Jesus was and who, you know, what the gospel actually was. And I did experience a genuine change, a genuine transformation at the heart level. I felt like there were things that, you know, hangups and things that I couldn't shake for the life of me. And I started really changing these things and really making some great strides forward in changing my life. And so, yeah, it was a great experience in the beginning. And for several years going forward, I thought, you know, I really believe that I found the place that God wanted me to be in. And he really, I think, used the people there and took really good care of me.
So you were changing, you saw your whole life change, you saw mm-hmm. things turn around and it felt like I have the family that I didn't have, right? The family that was broken. Yep. And now I have something that feels healthy and connective.
And well, this is what's funny too, Sandy, is that the people that the people that study the Bible with me and were with me and baptized me and showed me, you know, how to live as a Christian, it was sort of this ragtag bunch of guys and girls that I didn't know it at the time, but I learned later that they were kind of going against the grain of the institutional flow. And so they were really about relationships and really about, you know, we would have these small groups and it was really relationally connected. There were people that were really, they love God. We love each other. There was no agenda. There wasn't an agenda, at least at that time. I was really shielded and protected from that. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really experience a lot of the political side of church or the institutional side of church until I was probably about a year involved, you know? And then things kind of took a turn, I would say.
And it reminds me of what we were talking about before we started about how, you know, you can come to an institution that may have some very destructive tendencies, but you may get connected to some really great people. I know Absolutely. I had the same experience. I got connected to some really great people and I didn't realize, kind of like you in the beginning, that there was destruction in this environment. I thought I had That's found right. something really amazing. And yet, you know, you and I were talking about how you can have really amazing people that love God and want to do the right thing that can mm-hmm. still be involved in environments that are destructive. And we'll talk about that Absolutely. More, but tell me more about that transition. So you had this year, you mm-hmm. were sheltered from things that you didn't realize were going on, but mm-hmm. you're feeling different. Your life is different. You're feeling good. And then when did you start to notice that there were some maybe problems within the institution?
Well, it's interesting because after I was there for about a year, maybe a little less, but you know, about that, I got introduced to, or I got invited to the leaders meeting. And the leaders meeting was very different than the church community. The leaders meeting was very, I would definitely say intentional, but there was a very corporate feel. There was a very, we are driven to accomplish something feel. And now, again, I didn't have a background in sales until many years later. So I didn't get it and realize, but what I now know after working in sales for many years is that the leaders meeting was sort of modeled after your average corporate sales meeting. And so there were stats and numbers and, you know, how are you going out there and selling the church? You know, how many people are you getting to church? How many baptisms? How many this, how many that? And, you know, it's funny because coming from, you know, being in my early 20s and coming from a relatively, you know, clueless place, you know, just barely in college and all these different things. Yeah, I guess it's normal. I guess that's just what we do. Okay, this must be the next level. And there was enough Bible preached and there were enough things said that made it seem normal enough to me. Like, okay, well, this is just what we need to do to go out and make disciples. Jesus does say make disciples. Absolutely. So if you're saying that this is how we need to do it, then I guess, okay, I guess that's what we do. But as things started to progress, there were just a lot of tactics and, you know, very shaming tactics. Thing, you know, if someone didn't have a visitor to church, or if a particular leader didn't meet their baptism goal for the month, even they would get rebuked, or they would get, you know, not always harshly like lit up, but sometimes it would just be, you know, enough of a admonishment to where, you know, you could definitely see that the person, the head guy, was not pleased, and he publicly would, you know. And so it was an environment that was very performance driven. And again, because the world, like a sales organization, a corporation, a military organization, they are very performance driven. So it was obviously familiar to us as human beings. But what I didn't see at the time was how not like Jesus the model was. You know, it was a lot more about performing than it was about really receiving and becoming like Jesus. You know, it was more do the things that Jesus is doing, but not so much about becoming more like him, if that makes sense.
Makes so much sense. Yeah. And it makes a lot of sense too about what you said about the shame-based, because a leader maybe trying to encourage somebody to do better is not always a bad thing. Right. But when you are rebuking somebody, even if it's gently, but if you're doing it publicly and making it about numbers, now you've gone from, you're not encouraging that person, you're not supporting, you're not mentoring that person.
That's right.
You are really basically saying to that person, get in line. Because shame, as you and I both know, is a very big motivator.
That's right.
And so if I am, I will do anything to avoid the feelings of shame. And especially when it's coming from people in authority.
And if you come from a background, if your family of origin is one of deep shame and criticism, it almost feels normal to receive that from a leader, from a church leader. And it doesn't occur to you that, wait a minute, that's not okay. It's for me anyway, it was like, well, of course that's what you do to get me motivated, because I'm a, you know, worthless degenerate anyway. So yeah, I need you to mistreat me because that's how I, you know, am going to grow and become what I'm supposed to be. That was the mindset that I went into it with. And I think, again, family of origin, you know, I think especially with my dad was a very hard, critical man. And so when I became a Christian, I naturally gravitated toward very hard and critical men. And the funny thing is, men that tend to be harsh, men and women that tend to be harsh, tend to also be the type of people that get a lot of things done. And so what I think can happen is that an organization can overlook a lot of the harsh tendencies, even abusive tendencies, because the numbers are speaking. You know, well, we're getting we're filling the seats, we're getting the baptisms, we're getting the, you know, the people are here. But, you know, what's interesting to me is that a lot of the realities weren't being talked about. Like, why are we losing just as many people as we're gaining? Why is that, you know? And it's very easy to be like, well, because they just weren't committed and they don't love the Lord. And it's like, well, no, I think they're being mishandled. Many of them, maybe not all, but many are being mishandled. And so it's almost like you get to this kind of weird place, at least that's where it was for me. And I think where I was connected, where you almost justify harsh and abusive behavior because you're getting the results, but then you're not even being realistic about the results and it's like, we're not really growing at the rate that we're wanting to. But it's because we've developed this sort of this program that has tried to bypass the needs of people for the sake of more people, if that makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, that language, and you and I have definitely talked about that, of there's such a big difference between difficult and destructive. Now what you're sharing, it's this environment starts to be destructive. Versus the normal difficulties that you'll have when people are together.
That's right.
And I think a lot of times, to your point, we don't realize that it's destructive, because, you know, eventually you and I were in the same church, because there was a lot of churches that are connected into the same church. And that's how Curtis and I got to know each other, and, you know, have been friends ever since. But it's so true. It's so easy to miss that. It's so easy to feel like, well, it's hard because people are hard and it's just difficult. And then, but we miss destructive because we grew up in destructive, and destructive was made normal. It sounds like that's a lot what was happening for you, especially in those earlier years. Like, you had this first year of oh, this is amazing. And then you start to see these things. But by then, you're also really connected to the church, I would imagine, at that point anyway.
And, you know, you don't really, very, very much so. And for me, you know, coming into the church, I didn't really have the, I didn't have great boundaries. I didn't really understand what soul care and self-care and all these things that, you know, obviously now as a grief specialist, I mean, it's something that I highly value for myself and others. But I think at that time, I didn't really understand that that was a thing or that was something that should be, you know, pursued. And so the mindset for me was almost like, well, I guess, you know, the Christian life is just this grind and dealing with this environment is just part of it. Like, you know, Jesus suffered and I guess this is suffering, you know. There wasn't an understanding that, well, no, actually you are allowed to say no to dysfunctional behavior. You're allowed to say no. You don't have to go along with some, but you know, and that's the thing is that a lot of times there would be these church campaigns and different things where, you know, it was just like, yeah, the church is doing it and we're just going to go for it. You know, there was, you know, there would be these big, you know, neighborhood canvassing things. And some of the stuff that we were pushing out there, I didn't agree with. I was like, I don't do that. I don't want to do that. But it was almost like, well, it doesn't matter. You're part of the church and you got to do it. And so I think a lot of what happens, at least for me, is that it was almost like we were allowed to compromise the individual for the sake of the institution. And it was, or the collective, or the community. And I think biblically what I realize is that there's a premium put on both. There's a premium put on individuals and a premium put on community. I don't think it's an either or. I think the way I see it biblically is that it's healthy people that make up a healthy community. You don't get a healthy community without healthy people. And I think what the mindset was almost like, well, we're gonna ignore or bypass the needs of people and just say, well, you just got to, you know, we're just going to compel you to do community. And that just doesn't work. People are not wired. We're wired for a deep intimacy with God that moves us at the heart level. We are designed to be transformed by the Spirit of Christ at the heart level. And that means that it takes time and it's not always as fast and it doesn't always feel as efficient as we might want it to feel when it comes to connecting with Christ, you know? And so you have this really weird conflict, you know? It's like, so on the one hand, as a human being, I have this need to really connect intimately with God and really discover his will for my life. And that's not always instant. And then you have these very, very demanding requirements of an organization where it's like, well, it doesn't matter what you think or what you feel, you just got to do it. And you're like, well, I don't know about that. That just doesn't feel like it doesn't seem like that's what I'm being called to by God, but you're saying that that's how I need to serve God based on what you want. And I think, honestly, we put church leaders at such a high, you know, at least in the organization that we were a part of, it was like, this person gets to kind of tell anybody and everybody what to do without any question. And then you throw in and if you question, there's something wrong with you. You're prideful or rebellious or whatever it is. So it was just this weird coercive technique that, again, it felt very normal to people like myself who came from very weird and coercive family backgrounds.
Completely. And there's a lot of gaslighting in that as well. Like 100%. What you're saying, that gaslighting. Yeah. And also, you know, I would imagine for somebody like you, I know I feel like this was true for me too. When you grow up in those kind of environments, you learn how to perform in dysfunction. You learn how to put a face on, you learn how to do that. And I feel like that environment that you're describing, the same environment that I was in too, you have somebody like you or somebody like me that comes along, and we also get like accolades and value because we can perform, we can do those things. And so now we're white knuckling our performance but there's an element I imagine of being seen, because I know you went on to be in leadership and all of that kind of stuff. So what really led you into those positions, do you feel like?
So I think, you know, it's funny, when I became a Christian, I really had just a genuine passion for God. And I still do. I mean, I feel like I believe that we have to constantly grow and be transformed by Christ. So by the Spirit of Christ. So I think in the very beginning, there was just this desire and calling to help other people to know Jesus. And I didn't think of the ministry I kind of saw it as a sacrifice. Like you're kind of having to give up a lot. And it was true to a degree. I mean, there was a lot of self-denial. I mean, the pay was not, you know, at least for me, you know, wasn't anything to write home about, you know, and you made things work because you were committed to really the mission, you know, of really making disciples. But I think what happened later, what I think one of the realities of the leadership culture was that it was a very authoritarian top-down approach. And it's interesting because obviously in the scriptures, Jesus time and time again says, don't be like the leaders, you know, not so with you. You know, it's not your job to be an authoritarian, you know, you tell everyone else what to do. Yes. But, you know, it's interesting when you're in an environment, a church environment like that, a lot of times very simple scriptures can be ignored, you know, for the sake of the progress of the organization, you know. Scriptures like, you know, don't raise up a young, you know, convert into being an overseer because he'll become conceited. Well, we had a lot of young guys that became preachers and overseers that were conceited, and we, you know, and we saw a lot of the consequences, unfortunately, of that lack of experience and a lack of maturity. People crash and burn, you know, in a spiritual environment when they're not when they're pushed too fast. I think there were there was a central figure. I won't get into the details, but there was a central figure that was sort of the main guy for a while. And I think a lot of the techniques and tricks and things that were in the organization kind of came from, they were kind of his brainchild. But, you know, there were a lot of loyal people that also adopted those same things. So it really spread into the culture to where even after he was gone, it was still there. It was still a part of it, you know, up until, you know, even today, you know. And well, let me say this too. I consider the people that then and now, they're my brothers and sisters in Christ. And I think one of the things that I didn't know how to do then was really separate God from the cultural toxicity. Mm. So God and the culture were kind of the same thing. And it was like, if you question the culture, you're questioning God. So who would dare do that? You know? So I think one of the things that grief work really helped me to do was to really get honest about some of the painful things, and land in a place where I didn't have to demonize the church, but definitely had to look at some of the toxic practices and denounce those. You know, I could still love the people, but I had to. I have no intention of repeating the toxicity. It's once you kind of see things for what they are, you can't go backward. You it's repulsive. It's like, I'm not going back to that. But again, at the time it was very much just a part of it. So I think, you know, just accepting it at that time as normal or as the way it is. And there would be these private conversations behind closed doors about how messed up the system was, but you wouldn't dare, you know, which later on down the line, when I did start to question some of the systemic problems, there were some pretty weighty consequences, you know, excommunication or, you know, being slandered or labeled or, you know, hey, I'm just trying to speak out to what I, about something that I feel like could be improved or changed to make things better for people. And, you know, if it was somebody else's baby that, you know, so-and-so came up with this ministry idea, you know, that ministry idea is kind of hurting people because it's more performance oriented or whatever. You were kind of labeled as the bad guy for even having the questions about it. And I think it was just sort of after a while, I think you realize that what was really happening is what was that people's egos were more driving the organization than a sincere desire for change, you know?
I appreciated what you said about the roots, kind of the DNA of the organization, you know, because there was, like you said, that one central leader who had, you know, autonomy, authority. And then even after he was gone and things were supposed to be different, which is when I actually came in, it had a semblance of that. But because those roots were never dealt with, to your point, the same systemic problems were happening, maybe a bit more veiled when I came in, but they were there. Yeah. And right. As they became more and more clear and obvious, and, you know, those of us that started to speak up, you know, we started to say, wait a minute, this is really hurting people. Like, to your point, young people were being very harmed, being covered up. I mean, it just wasn't a great environment for anyone. And yet when you spoke up, it was, well, you're prideful, or you're coming against this leader, or you just have a vendetta, or you just don't really know, or you're just not close to God. And I feel like one of the things that I also heard a lot, and I'm sure you did too, people would say, well, you need to be the change. You need to stay and facilitate change here. And I don't know if this ever happened for you, but I know for me, one of the things that happened is I really got to the point where I realized staying is the problem, because by staying, what I'm saying is that on some level, I'm agreeing with what's here, because there's not a willingness really to change at the root level. And I wonder if you came up against some of the same ideas.
Oh, very much so. Well, you know, now I'm part of a house church community. I love what, you know, we're doing. Many of the people within the house church community that I'm a part of come from the church that we're talking about. And I think leaving was one of the hardest things, because it was almost like, well, you know, if you're not here to help, then who's going to do that? And there's a tremendous amount of pressure, because I think it's almost like if you somehow get healthy enough to function well, you're seen as sort of the person that needs to get thrown back into the, you know, it's like taking a healthy thing and throwing it into a toxic thing and hoping that it's going to spread. It's like, it actually doesn't work that way. What I've seen is that it works the opposite. You know, toxic will overrun and overtake healthy. And again, if we're talking about a toxic environment, I mean, we're talking about an environment that attracts a certain type of person. In order to do well in it, you have to be willing to shut your eyes and your ears and your mouth and be willing to just play along. And if you become a person who starts to open his eyes and ears and mouth and speak up and call, then you are not considered an asset in that environment. So I think in my case, there was that point where people wanted me to stick it out. But then eventually when they saw that, he's not really willing to play ball, then it was probably more desirable for some that I go elsewhere, you know, and that's the sad reality. You could spend years of your life committed to and building relationships. And I mean, I hate to say it, but one leader that decides, you know, they've had enough of you, can change the whole thing, and you're, next thing you know, you're on the outs, you know. And all of those people, that's the other thing that can be difficult, is, you know, people kind of decide, you know, okay, well, if he's not here, then he must not be in favor of what we're doing as a church, so we probably shouldn't call him or whatever. And, you know, I was never disfellowshipped or marked or anything, that some of the things that they've done, that as a church, but, you know, relationally, I definitely felt the disapproval, when I was unwilling to go along with what I felt was just a toxic approach, you know? And then it's, what's also interesting, Sandy, is, you know, you have a lot of conversations with people after they've kind of realized what was going on. And, you know, it's very, so, I mean, everyone, what were we doing? Like, I'm, you know, I've apologized to many people. I've had many people apologize to me, because it's almost like when you come out of that sort of groupthink, that toxic groupthink environment, and you start to really recognize what was going on, you know, you feel really embarrassed. I know there are a lot of people that, you know, kind of disappear, you know, they, you know, sadly, some people even denounce the faith, you know, because again, that the two get enmeshed, and people don't have the wherewithal to separate organization from God. And so they end up just kind of lumping it all together and rejecting all of it. And I think that's one of the saddest things that I've dealt with a lot in doing grief work with church people, is that some people lose their faith because they felt so damaged by people, you know?
It's so true. And kind of to your point, Curtis, because we were in the same church for a number of years. I mean, the church that we're talking about has churches all over the world, but mm-hmm. we were in the same actual ministry.
Yep.
And church for a number of years. And I feel like you were, in a good way, one of those, you know, pillar people. You know, people knew you, you were kind, you were compassionate, you were known for having a heart for people. You were really known for having a heart for the individual. I think one of the things that I always noticed about you, and I always knew about you, is that, you know, if you ran into me, you know, you were going to make sure you said hi, you were going to make sure you connected. And you were really good at making people feel special, you know, because I think that's your heart. You just really see people, and you're for people. Mm. And the word that was coming up for me as you were talking too, is this whole idea of discarding. And, you know, Curtis and I did a whole series on church abuses. We've got a few series actually, and I'll make sure to post it in the comments for any of you that want to engage on a, you know, on a deeper level. But it's this discarding. It's like, here, you've given your heart, you've given your life, you know, you've been in there. And to your point, when you're in an environment like that, there is this level of, like you said, indoctrination. And when you're in something very toxic that is existing for, everything is about the organization, and the organization isn't really about the people, even if that's spoken, a lot of times that's just a manipulation to keep people for the organization. People are often tired, giving in all different types of ways, and then it still wasn't quite enough. And yet when you get to that point where you are no longer supporting the image of the organization, then comes that the discarding and the, well, you know, you're being pushed away in a variety of ways.
That's right.
And so, go ahead.
No. It's just, it's interesting because the discard is really kind of a mark of an unhealthy environment. But I can remember, you know, over the course of time, seeing many of the discarders get discarded. You know, it's a cyclical thing where, you know, really no one is safe. You know, the people that were some of the like main destructive people that were in our organization, they were eventually discarded, you know? And so it becomes a very deep, sick cultural part of the organization, but no one's safe. And it's like, wow, you know, we buy into it, not realizing that you practice discarding long enough and you're probably going to be on the other end of it at some point, because it's just spreads throughout the culture, you know?
Definitely. It definitely spreads. And that type of culture always looks for scapegoats. You know, obviously mm-hmm. it's not a conscious thing, but it's like you said, it's a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a problem. It's not the organization that's a problem. Mm-hmm. There has mm-hmm. to be a person or people that are the problem. And yeah. then when you have people speaking up and then they leave, then other people have to be the problem.
That's right.
And so there's always this desire to find a scapegoat, because that protects the organizational image, which is mm-hmm. the polar opposite of what we find in the Bible and what we find, you know, with the churches and even the way that Paul often wrote letters and spoke to the churches. It was very, very different mm-hmm. than, you know, driving people to be in an image framework. Did you find that your desire, because I know you've had a deep desire of, you know, I've known you for a while and you've been on this journey for a while of being healthy, of healing. Do you feel like that is one of the things that helped you not only see what was happening in the organization, but also differentiate between God and people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, because I think, you know, grief work was the first thing that really opened my eyes. You know, grief work was what helped me to realize that inner work needs to be a part of my process, my life. But I think what really helped me, 2013, I'd basically gotten out of the full-time ministry and was going through a definite midlife crisis and just kind of trying to figure out what was what, and wife and two kids, and, you know, just lost the thing that I thought was going to do for the rest of my life. But I was introduced to some of the spiritual formation literature, like, you know, Dallas Willard, Andrew Murray, where, you know, I mean, these guys are talking about organizing your life around, you know, taking care of your heart, you know. And there was such a contrast that it was like, wait a minute, you really, Curtis, you have to decide whether you're going to take care of your heart or you're going to get yanked back into the deal, you know? And I think what happens is, obviously, when an organization is not healthy and individuals start to get healthy, there's just going to be a divide. And you don't want it to be there. I didn't want there to be a divide. But you get to the point where you go, well, wait a minute. When I do this, I feel secure, healthy, close to God. When I do what you're saying, I feel insecure, scattered, you know, all over the place, anxious. Okay, I don't want to feel that. I want to feel this. I want to be what God has designed me to be. You know, I want the fruit of the Spirit to be what is who I am. So yeah, I think there's such a deep contrast that if a group is not focused on producing healthy people, but individuals are focused on becoming healthy, you're going to have a problem every time. I mean, it's just, it's not that you have to be, you know, I didn't go on like a formal campaign against. It was just, hey, guys, there's some healthy things out there that we could start doing. And it was interesting because me and some friends started incorporating these. There was a, you know, this great 12-week program that focused strictly on intimacy with God. And so many people were like loving this thing. But when some of the staff got introduced to it, it was like they were repulsed by it. They were like, this is not, you know, one guy couldn't even sit in his seat. I mean, he would just get up and leave, and, you know, he had, you know, other important things to do, and he eventually fell off and didn't even finish the thing. But it was like, you could see that, like, there is, from what I observed, there was an active, like, resistance to healthy practices. Mm. And what I will say too is that when people aren't focusing on healthy individuals or being a healthy individual, what I've found, and you can probably share a lot about this with grief work, but what we tend to do is we tend to become overly concerned with social issues and changing the social environment, you know, so that we can, bypass and mask what we need to be doing personally. So what ended up happening in our organization was that people were becoming experts on what everyone else needed to change out there in the, you know, in society, but we couldn't even talk about or deal with some of the toxicity in our own backyard. And so you're like, and it was mad because you're like, wait a minute, we're trying to change like people that haven't even made a commitment to Jesus. We're trying to tell people that haven't made a commitment to Jesus, they need to be more like Jesus, but we can't even help people who are committed to Jesus to love each other and treat each other with respect and take responsibility when we've hurt one another. Like you said, the thing that happened with the youth ministry, it was clear and obvious that there was malpractice within the group, but no one in leadership wanted to address the real issues. And so it was almost like the smoke screen became, let's get into the social, you know, arena, which I'm fine with. I do that, but you can't do that and not deal with your own interior life. That's the problem. You can't bypass your own spiritual health for the sake of I'm going to go out and be a warrior for justice in the world. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't work at all. And some of the things that you described, it reminds me of some of the times I've talked about these type of environments. One of the things that I'll say is I feel like an environment like that often pressures people to behave as if they are exhibiting the fruits of the spirit, but they're doing it through the works of the flesh. It's behavior modification. It's image driven. You're not concerned, like you said, about the inner life, the inner heart, the inner intimacy, but you're really just putting pressure on people to conform. And unfortunately, that environment does lead to people being in control and desiring power and desiring numbers over caring about people and the heart of Jesus.
That's right.
And to your point too, when people are telling you things that are in authority as if this is what God says, it muddies the water. You know, it really muddies the water. And, you know, I like you, have worked with a lot of people where they've had to have a time of even just deconstructing what it is that they learned. And I find a lot of times if they don't, then they end up pushing against it. And, you know, like you said, walking away from the faith, but that's almost right. out of their pushing against something versus healing. And yet at the same time, I've also seen that be a part of somebody's journey where they might push against it and then go into healing. And, you know, that all can be a process. But I feel like for me, and I know for you too, the healing really helped me to differentiate between what was said, what was taught, and then what was truly the Father's heart. Because a lot of times those were very, very different things. And so would you agree with that as far as healing and
100%? Well, you know, it's funny because you had mentioned like deconstructing, you know, which, you know, I'm a huge fan of on one level, but I'm not a fan of on another, because, you know, when we're talking about dismantling unhealthy practices within an organization, I think we need to deconstruct it all. I mean, it's like, hey, anything that's been introduced to a church culture that isn't biblical, we need to be free to question it and denounce anything that's not biblical. But unfortunately, what happens with deconstruction is it turns into, well, is Jesus even really God? Or, you know, is it, you know what I mean? So it's, and again, I think that's what happens oftentimes in a toxic environment, is everything gets pulled together. And so I think the type of deconstruction that I have tried to practice myself is really the separation from God and organization or institution. Because Jesus is still Jesus. I mean, he's still the way, the truth, and the life. He's still everything. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand that when someone is in that place, there is a need perhaps to grieve and deal. And I'm not saying that, you know, they're gonna catch flack from me if they're having a problem with God. But I am saying that for me, it was something that I definitely had to be careful and navigate well, because I was tempted to just chuck it all, you know? Because, and I guess that's more a statement of how well the two things can become enmeshed in the hearts and minds of the people. And the scriptures, the spirit, the connection with God, that has to be something that we prioritize. That has to be something that, in my experience, that has been something, the Spirit of Christ, Jesus, the Bible, has been a major part of my healing process. You know what I mean? It's not the problem. And that's the thing that I think has been a heartbreaker for me, is I think some people have drawn the conclusion, well, Christianity is the problem. Jesus is the problem. The Bible is the problem. And it's like, no, I don't. I think the Bible is what it says it is. Jesus is who he says he is. He's a healer. He loves you unconditionally. He wants to love you and care for you and take care of you. He's calling you to a life of, you know, lifting the burdens from your shoulders and really helping you to walk in the way that you are designed to. But again, I think a lot of times, you know, when we're beat down in our homes and then we're beat down in a church environment, it's very easy in our psyche to transition that into, and I guess God is that way too. I guess God's mad at me. God doesn't like me. He, you know, he's just trying to deprive me or whatever. And for me, that's probably been the hardest part with all of this, is that, you know, many years removed, many friends who've been years removed. Some people are landing on their feet and doing really well. Some people have spiraled out and they're, you know, not doing well. And, you know, I think for me, the reason why, you know, with transition coaching and grief recovery work and all these things, you know, I guess I'm really passionate about helping people to restore their faith, their true faith, you know, and yes, detach and disconnect from the toxic environment that they were in, and see that those two things are not the same. It's not that toxic environment was not Jesus. It was not God's will. It was not what God wanted. And God is good. And he still wants to love you and care for you. That's maybe that's been a message to myself that has had the most positive impact, is really learning about God, but not abandoning the faith, not abandoning, you know, what it means to live for Jesus.
That is so good, because like you said, a lot of times when people spiral or are in that place, it can feel like it's pervasive, like it's going to be the way that it always is, as opposed to it could be an opportunity to work through things. And I have two other things before we close. One of them being, you know, we're talking a lot about the church hurt, and yet you had spoken about the home life, what you grew up in. Did you also find that healing from your home life also helped you not only to heal from the toxicity of the church environment, but also to separate from it?
100%. Because the thing I realized about wounds is that they transcend, you know, your wound from home is going to play out in work and social and church and everywhere else. And I think it really gets into the idea of what we bring to the environment, you know. One of the things that I learned or realized was that the reason why I was magnetically attracted to certain things was because they were not resolved within me, you know? And I really think that, you know, I teach this in a lot of my grief work, is that, you know, grief is like a magnet and it will be attracted to what is familiar. If it's unresolved, it's going to magnetically be pulled. And so I think that's the thing that has really helped me, is by going in and really grieving my past, my family, my, you know, everything, not only did it impact my ability to navigate the toxic environments, but I also realized that I can grieve the toxic environment as well, the church environment. And I've done a lot of church work. I've done a lot of work. I've done grief work on, you know, the organization that we were part of. And what's interesting is I can, maybe not perfectly, but more than I ever have been able to, I can be very objective, loving, and kind to some of the individuals that are still stuck in that environment, or, you know, even the people that I felt directly hurt by. I don't feel a deep animosity or like, you know, I can't stand you. I don't want to be around you. I feel a genuine love and acceptance because I learned that same thing with my dad. You know, I learned to love my dad where he was at. Now, I think the great thing about doing grief work is that you can learn how to set up incredibly just effective boundaries with dysfunction, where you learn to say no, but you don't have, it doesn't have to come from a place of I'm angry or I'm you know, I'm in this constant internal battle with you. It's more like, no, I'm not doing that. Well, we don't like that you said, well, I'm okay with you not liking it. Not going to do it. I'm going to do this though. And, you know, just, I think what I found in grieving my family is it's taken a lot of the emotional charge out of a lot of the painful things that have occurred in my life, including church wounds, you know? And it's interesting because, you know, when you can, you know, maybe bump into somebody and just there be no problem, it's like, hey, I'm not going to call healthy unhealthy or health unhealthy healthy anymore, but love you and amen. Let's, you know, let's keep it moving, you know?
Which is really great because then you, like you said, you can have those great boundaries around what is toxic, mm-hmm. and then you can move into being surrounded by what is healthy. Yeah. And that's I think one of the powerful things. I wanted to share one little quick story and then I'm going to ask you for a final thought. But mm-hmm. I was just remembering Curtis, there was a midweek where Curtis and I were going to share in front of everyone. And we were in this process of talking about the Holy Spirit. And we were part of a church that did not embrace the gifts of the Holy Spirit at all. And God had really put it on my heart to share this kind of self-deliverance experience that I'd had. But I was thinking, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. And Curtis had some big things that he wanted to share. And I remember right before we went up to share, and we were the first group to go. We were the first two to share. I remember yeah. Curtis like tapped my arm and he's like, we just need to go for it. We just need to go for it. And it like gave me permission. Mm-hmm. And what was so funny is, so Curtis shared his, I shared mine. It was kind of like bombs on the audience. I had a lot of people reach out to me about what I shared, but it was also this really big thing. And I noticed that after that, the leaders then stepped in and kind of really monitored things with the other people that shared because you and I kind of went for it. But it was great because it really did speak to a number of people. But that story was just coming in my heart. I just thought that
I loved it. Yeah. Yeah. It was a defining moment, I think, for both of us. Yeah.
I do too.
Definitely.
I do too. I think for both of us in different ways, we went from, we're in this environment where there's still a bit of people pleasing to, I'm going to listen to the Holy Spirit and I'm going to do and go where God calls me, which leads me to just like a final point. I think a lot of what we've been talking about is really how so much of this toxicity, it just doesn't reflect the Father's heart. And if we really understood the Father's heart, we'd realize that that isn't Him. You know, there's other things that are Him, but that isn't Him. So for people that may be struggling with church hurt or cult hurt, as I like to say, right? Or destructive hurt or
good word,
people in the name of God who have done terrible things, what would be your final thoughts? What would you say to them?
I think there's light outside of the dark tunnel that you're in right now. God is a lot bigger than your environment that you're currently struggling in. And he will show up. And he might show up with, in unlikely ways with unlikely people. But he's going to help you to get out of this in one piece. And he's going to help you to learn how to be a healthy, thriving follower of Jesus. So don't give up. Do not give up. And dysfunction is a part of the human experience. And unfortunately, sometimes God has to allow us to experience dysfunction in places that we don't necessarily want to experience dysfunction, just to remind us that he's really the only one that could ever satisfy and deliver us, you know? And you can get to a point where you can love your abuser. That's another thing I'll say, you know? And that might sound like an impossible statement, but by being willing to heal and deal and really engage your own heart need, you can get to a place where you can soar well beyond the effects of the wounds and actually love those that have been, you know, less than loving to you.
Thank you so much for that. That was great. Thank you for those final thoughts. And I, especially on the love part, because I feel like, to your point, with healing, you learn a new definition of love. And it has nothing to do with codependency. It has nothing to do with condoning, has nothing to do with people pleasing. It has everything to do with truth and honor and respect, yeah, which takes you into a totally different place. So thank That's you right. so much for being
You're
on
so
today,
welcome,
Curtis.
Sandy. So it's good been to be amazing. Here. So good to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to Reflections of the Father's Heart podcast. It's been an honor to be with you on this episode. I want to let you know that if you'd like to read Living Born Again, you can find it and the companion workbook on Amazon. I also want you to know that there's going to be incredible and amazing guests week over week over week. Jesus taught in parables because story has the power to equip and to transform. So remember to tune in and be transformed by stories that help you to deepen your understanding of the Father's heart.